Hi, welcome back to our podcast 2, looking at making safeguarding personal. And we're very fortunate again to have Aidy Cooper talking about this. She will introduce herself and introduce the point she wants to raise in the podcast 2. Over
Thanks.
To you, Aidy.
Thanks, Ed. So just by way of introduction about what I'm currently doing, I'm currently the chair of 3 safeguarding adult boards, and I also work for the local government association, the Care and Health Improvement in Programme as their safeguarding lead, and also the Care and Health Improvement Advisor for London. I'm still the co-chair of the Association of Directors of Adult Social Services, Safeguarding Adults Policy Network. So I'm going to talk a bit about what making safeguarding personal is about and what does it mean for practice. So making safeguarding personal is an approach to safeguarding. What it means is that the way we do safeguarding adults is person-led, so it's about them and what they want to do and how they understand what they're doing. It's outcome focused, so we're focused on what we're trying to help change. It's about enhancing their involvement, choice, and control. And it's also about improving their quality of life. So it's both well-being and safety. Broadly, I'd describe it as a change in culture and practice, or an approach to safeguarding adults. And we started doing work on this in about 2009. But since then, this approach has been incorporated in the statutory guidance. So it's now the way we should and must approach how we safeguard adults.
Okay,
so in translating that to what we do, what are the principles? Well, there are some ways of thinking about this in terms of maybe how we used to undertake our safeguarding adult work and how we need to do it now. So the first thing is about enabling safeguarding to be done with and not to people. So working with the people who we're concerned about, rather than in that professional gift model of we know what's best and we'll do what's right for you. It's a shift from a process supported by conversations to a series of conversations supported by a process. So we're not saying that process and procedures are unnecessary. They're there to support the conversations that we have with people. But it's not just about a conversation. It's what do we do with what people are telling us about their lives and what they want to happen. So we talk with people through the options they have and what they want to do about their situation. We can't be in people's lives, or very rarely, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So what we are trying to aim to do in our work in safeguarding adults is support people to keep themselves safe and to be able to manage the risks that they have in their lives. It's also about ensuring an emphasis on what would improve quality of life as well as safety. So in order to do that, we have to have a really good understanding of what people want to achieve, how they want to achieve it, and we need to record what their outcomes are or what they want to change in their lives, and then see if we're being able to help them meet that effectively or not. Making safeguarding personal is also about using professional skills rather than putting people through a process. So it's not about ticking boxes, have we got the right meetings, but it's about using the professional skills that we have, and I would include all professions, not just social work, nursing, occupational therapy, a whole range of environmental health if we're coming to hoarding and self-neglect. It's using the whole range of skills that we have in order to support people to achieve the outcomes that need to be met. It's about achieving meaningful improvement in people's circumstances. What's the point of doing this unless we can help people improve their lives? And I think finally it's developing an understanding of the difference that we make for the outcomes for people at risk of abuse and neglect. And I'm going to park that because I'm hoping that that will be picked up in another podcast about how do we know the impact of interventions in adult safeguarding through the Making Safeguarding Personal voluntary return. So moving back to practice, so how do we actually do it? What is making safeguarding personal about? So it's about enabling and empowering people to talk about what's important to them and express what they want to happen. So it's about talking with, listening to, making sure that whatever we do, they're at the centre, that their wishes are discussed and agreed with them, not just at the beginning of the process, not at the point, just at the point of raising the concern, but if their process carries on, whatever process that we that is used, that they're engaged with that throughout, and acknowledging that maybe what people want as outcomes might change. So one of the years when Research into Practice did an evaluation of the Making Safeguarding Personal program, it was, I think, 2014-15, they came up with this concept of negotiated outcomes. So what people might want at the beginning of the process and what they might want towards the end of the process may shift. We don't, sure. That's fine. People change. Sure. What they want may change. So it's about keeping in touch with what somebody wants to happen throughout the process, and through the, particularly to the protection planning or helping to achieve resolution and recovery. So we are trying to help people resolve the circumstances that they're in, recover from the abuse or neglect, and realise the things that matter to them in their life. So we ask them, what do you want to be different? And then we make sure that those differences are able to be achieved, and how. And finally, it's about deciding with them how effective that has been, because in the longer term, as I say, people have to be able to keep themselves safe from harm and abuse. And underlying all of this, we have to think about human rights, and that human rights approach is implicit in Making Safeguarding Personal, but I want to make it explicit. Sure. So one of the things that I would say that we've learned since probably the temperature check in 2016 is that in implementing a change in the way in which we do safeguarding work and how we safeguard adults, that there have been some misconceptions about Making Safeguarding Personal. So one of the misconceptions, which I feel very strongly about, is when people, maybe their response is, no, I don't want you in my life. Mm-hmm. And the most obvious ones are in situations like domestic abuse or hoarding, when, you know, literally you're knocking at the door and somebody says, no, I'll go away, I don't want you in my life. And Making Safeguarding Personal isn't about walking away in those circumstances. It's a very simplistic way to think about it, sure. That just because someone says no on the surface, actually they don't want any help or need any help. So when people say no, in whatever way they might say it, we also have to consider our duties of care, public interest duties, what are the risks to other people. So a simple example of that would be paid carer financially abusing a service user, and that person saying, but I really like this person, I like what they do, I don't want you to take it forward. And we would say, as professionals, but we have to, because they might be also financially abusing all the other people they see, and actually this is their, you know, it's a disciplinary and activity, and we know that you like him or her and you don't want it to happen, but we have professional duties to do this. So it's about explaining why we might want to go against somebody's preferences in terms of, and I know that's quite a simplistic case and these issues are often very complex, but it's how do we explain and talk to people about our duties that maybe impinge on their wishes in a negative way, in ways they don't want. The other, another issue that has arisen, I think, in the development of strength-based working, more generally, particularly across social work, is that concept of professional curiosity, that we need to look below the surface of what we're seeing. And I think there's a lot of learning from our children's colleagues about professional curiosity, particularly, for example, if you've got a relative or a carer who's saying everything is fine, but you sense that maybe things aren't fine. So you have to utilise that professional curiosity to pursue lines of inquiry to understand what's going on really in someone's life, to really be confident that you're meeting your, you know, responsibilities around safeguarding adults. We've also, I think, learnt that people in this field need to develop better legal literacy. And what I mean about that is not that everyone has to be a lawyer,
sure,
but that we have to understand what legal options might be appropriate to use to support someone to keep themselves safe from abuse and neglect. And just, for example, coercion control, domestic abuse legislation and powers might be helpful in mm-hmm. some safeguarding adult situations, but maybe historically people haven't thought across those legal areas to think about what might be most helpful. I think, similar to legal literacy, we've learned that competent practice in applying the Mental Capacity Act is absolutely critical to effective adult safeguarding, but also effective in terms of making safeguarding personal. To be delivering making safeguarding personal, we have to be competent in our practice around mental capacity, because we have to understand what the risks are for individuals, how they understand those risks, what their mental capacity is in respect of particular areas of their lives where they may appear to be competent and capable in dealing in other areas of their lives.
Sure.
And similar arising, the language is also similar, is arising from mental capacity, is around supporting unwise decisions and enabling risk appropriately to someone's personal circumstances. Now, this is really tricky, the whole area of unwise decisions. We have some guidance and support in terms of mental capacity, and we have some access to legal channels to manage this, but supporting unwise decisions and managing risks that are maybe unacceptable is a delicate balance, and there's some quite tricky cases that I know people are struggling with in this area. And finally, I think what we've learned in the last couple of years since the temperature check is that at a senior level, that the organisational culture has to be positive for frontline staff to be able to adopt a making safeguarding personal approach. So it's the strategic leadership management. It's not something that can be progressed if there are blocks within the hierarchy of management that are more risk averse, then frontline staff will be more risk averse. So it has to be a whole organisational culture shift, and it has to be across the partnership. It's no use if one, say, in adult social care people are less risk averse if colleagues in the police or health are very risk averse in certain circumstances. So it has to be a cultural shift across a partnership, which is why I would argue that safeguarding adult boards need to incorporate making safeguarding personal in their delivery plans and in their strategic objectives, so that people at the front line can see that at a very senior strategic level, the support for this area of culture change is really important. And it's not only important, it's essential. I was saying earlier that making safeguarding personal started off as good practice. We developed it because we thought it was a better way of working with people to achieve outcomes in their lives that would keep them, people would be able to keep themselves safer. It's now statutory. It's now something we must do. It's in the Care Act. It's the way in which we should undertake safeguarding work. And by way of conclusion, I'll just mention a book that I had the privilege of editing with Emily White. Just a bit of a plug. So with Emily, we pulled together a group of people who we really respect and trust to write chapters of a book. It's called Safeguarding Adults Under the Care Act 2014, Understanding Good Practice. And it's there as a tool, as a resource for people to adopt a making safeguarding personal approach, because all the people in the book talk about making safeguarding personal and this way of working with service users around adult safeguarding. But it also reinforces a number of the issues that I've already described, like legal literacy, and so on. So it's there as a resource for people to access if they're interested further.
That's great. Thanks very much for that. Much appreciated. That's A.D. Cooper speaking about making safeguarding personal in practice. And the book is available at all good bookshops.
And Amazon.
Thank you.